Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 43. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing two really good movies. The first one is from 1955, and it is The Quatermass Experiment, starring Brian Donlevy and a bunch of other people. And the second one is a really interesting John Sayles film from 1984, The Brother from Another Planet, starring Joe Morton. Both of them interesting in their own way, and both of them, there's a lot to say about them. So sit back, grab a drink, and we'll get the podcast started after I do the credits.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show.
Hey, how's everybody going? We're doing kind of okay here. The weather's warming up nicely. Springtime has sprung, which is a nice change. And there's not really too many great movies in the cinemas, but on the other hand, a lot of things are going to start coming out on discs soon that were big a few months ago, so it'll all work out in the end. I've got some interesting movies this time around. I wanted to do The Brother from Another Planet for a while because I'm a big John Sayles fan. I think Lone Star is one of the best movies of the last 20 years. But, so I thought I'd do that, and I hadn't watched it for a while, and I rewatched it and I enjoyed it. And then I thought I'd go back to some classic 1950s English science fiction, which is quite different from American science fiction in a lot of ways, and take a look at The Quatermass Experiment, the film adaptation that Hammer did of the original teleplays that were done a couple of years earlier by the BBC, based on the screenplays by Nigel Neal, one of the great science fiction media writers of the 20th century. So it's interesting to go back and do that. And, so we're going to do them in reverse order. Of course, we'll do them chronologically. So I'll look at The Quatermass Experiment first and then The Brother from Another Planet. But I'll just take a look a bit at what I'm watching. As that little grab I did after the credits will indicate, I've been mainlining episodes of classic Yu-Gi-Oh! From about 10 years ago. I got out my discs of them. We were rearranging some DVDs, as you do now and then. And I grabbed the box set and mainlined the first season of Yu-Gi-Oh! Almost continually, which took up a lot of time, but I kind of enjoyed it. I like a little bit of anime, and I kind of like the crazy drama of the dual monsters game that they play in the series. If you haven't seen Yu-Gi-Oh!, you're probably not going to know what I'm talking about. But then I acquired the other 5 seasons of it. So when I do my exercise on the elliptical machine, I'm basically watching an episode and a half of Yu-Gi-Oh! Because I do half an hour 5 days a week to try to stay in some kind of physical shape. And those kind of episodic, cartoony kind of things are a really good way of distracting myself from the fact that I'm sweating and puffing and doing all of those other things. So I'm mainlining Yu-Gi-Oh! At the moment. And I'm enjoying it. Yeah, it's kind of fun. I realise that it is at the level that it is, but it ain't too bad in spite of that. So let's have a look at what I've been watching. I've got my letterboxed up here. Let's see. Which is really fascinating for you guys while I look at it. I did see a movie. I rewatched Pat and Mike, which I'd done for Paleo Cinema a little while ago, because Liz, who I do the ABC local radio Northern Territory gig with, springs genres on me. So I've got to think of a movie in a specific genre to do for the next week's radio talk. and she sprung sports movies on me. Now, those who have listened for a while know that sports ain't my thing. So I decided to do the Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn comedy, Pat and Mike. And it went over well. Liz really liked it. It's got a few feminist threads through the plot, too, about women who are undermined by the men they're with and all that kind of thing. I talked about it in Paleo Cinema. Go back and listen to that episode. But, yeah, we both enjoyed it thoroughly and had a great time. And so after she sprung sport on me, because she knows full well that sport isn't my thing, we're going to do my favourite movie of all time next week, which is The Bad and the Beautiful, the Vincente Minnelli movie from 1952, starring Kirk Douglas and William Powell's in it, Walter Pidgeon's in it, Barry Sullivan, and Lana Turner. So we're going to do that one next time around, just as a way of making it up for the fact that she sprung a genre I don't really like. She may well do chick flicks next time, so I'm a little bit worried. But either way, we had fun with that. What else have I watched? I did watch The Crimson Kimono, the Sam Fuller movie, which was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed rewatching that with James Shigeta, Glenn Corbett and Victoria Shaw in it. And, yeah, it's got a lot to say about racism and the way people believe things, even if they have friends of another race, how the preconceptions that we have about those sort of things can cloud that a little bit. And that was a lot of fun to watch. And you're going to hear these clicking noises because I'm clicking my mouse to go between screens here. So I apologize for those little clicks that we get. And I did watch a science fiction movie, an Australian one from last year, The Rover, the David Michaud movie starring Guy Pearce, which is basically a post-collapse Australia where a man's on a quest to get his car back from a bunch of people who've stolen it. And on the way, he picks up the brother of one of the men, played by Robert Pattinson, the guy who was in Twilight. And Robin Pattinson's compound accent did annoy me a little bit. But apart from that, I really like the movie. I think it's a nice neo-Western in a sense. And it works really well in that. I do know the area around which it was filmed up near Corn in South Australia. Old copper mines up that way. And it's kind of, at times it's flat, but they've got some hills around there as well. It's at the bottom of the Flinders Ranges. Really interesting kind of area if you're cruising out that way. But yeah, I do recommend that one. So if you get a chance to see The Rover, definitely do. I did watch A Dandy and Aspic, the last movie Anthony Mann directed. He died before the end of directing it, and Lawrence Harvey, the star of the movie, finished the movie. It's a spy film, and I liked it in spite of the fact that I always find Lawrence Harvey to be an atrociously bad actor, as indeed do many other people. And, yeah, but in spite of that, I do like it. Tom Courtney's in it as well, and Mia Farrow playing an English girl, which is a little bit unusual. She was married to Sinatra at the time, and the marriage wasn't going well. And there were some disagreements about her leaving the production and coming back to where Sinatra was and all that kind of shit. But, yeah, it's a good spy movie from the 1960s. Not a perfect spy movie, but it's not a bad little effort. And the main thing I watched, which was really interesting, is a little bit of a desert noir from 1959 called The Trap, which stars Richard Widmark, Tina Louise, Lee J. Cobb, and Earl Holliman. Now, it's not a big film, but it's a really interesting little noir, and I really did enjoy it. I won't tell you too much about that because I want to talk about it in a future Paleo Cinema podcast. I might get a guest along for that one, but really recommend The Trap. And Lee J. Cobb is very good in it, apart from anybody else, and Widmark's good in it. I always like Widmark in tough guy roles. And the only other thing I've watched, beside the movies that I've watched for this podcast, is the Charles Band movie from the early 1990s, Doll Man, starring Tim Thomason as a kind of dirty Harry from an alien planet who comes to Earth chasing some bad guys and then finds out that he's about 2 inches tall compared to humans. And it's got the usual tropes of Charles Band's oeuvre, let's say. But on the other hand, it is a little bit of fun, and the effects are a little bit ropey, but that adds to the charm of them. Very much a VHS kind of movie, even though I've got a DVD rip of it. And Tim Thomason, interesting actor. I always like him in those Charles Band movies he did back in the day. And, I kind of enjoyed revisiting that, though. It was the first time I'd ever seen it widescreen, because all of the VHS tapes I had of this thing was in Pan and Scan, and it was kind of nice dipping into 90s nostalgia, let's say. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies, the wonderful Val Guest-directed Quatermass Experiment from 1955, I think it is, though we'll correct that after the break.
You can't escape it!
Maggie, look!
Nothing can destroy it! It's coming for you from space to wipe all living things from the face of the Earth! Beware of the creeping unknown! This woman is about to learn a terrible secret. She will never be the same again. Because this man knows that same secret, he will never speak again. To both of them has come terror in the form of the creeping unknown. Three men went into outer space. Only one of them came back. Came back a strange, distorted creature, haunted and possessed by something beyond human understanding. What was the terrible secret he could not tell them?
There's a whole new world out there, a wilderness, uncharted. And he's been there and come back. He's got the map. Unlock his mind for me, Briscoe, and find it. I know you can do it.
It isn't just a question.
I know the strain and tension you've been under, but to stop now when we're so close.
Brian Donlevy, he dared an experiment that shocked a nation.
You've destroyed him like you've destroyed everything else you've touched, Kent.
There's no room for personal feelings in science, Judith.
An experiment that created the creeping unknown.
I want to corner around the entire area, evacuate all public, get information to check up every movement that's likely to take place inside this radius tonight.
Yes, sir?
Warn everyone not to touch anything unusual they may find in the streets.
That's the American trailer for The Creeping Unknown, also known as The Quatermass Experiment. The Americans gave it that name for no good reason I can figure out. But anyway, so it's 1953, and Nigel Neal, the writer of the original screenplay for The Quatermass Experiment, is working for the BBC drama department as a scriptwriter. And he decides he wants to do a bit different now. He's working with a guy called Rudolf Cartier, who is a German emigre who left before World War II and who prior to that had been working at UFA with people like Billy Wilder and Fritz Lang and people like that. And Cartier and Neil decided that what they needed to do was to take the drama department of the BBC away from kind of stagey works, you know, things that were adaptations of stage plays or adaptations of literary works and things like that, and maybe do something new. Now, they had a six-week window to do a six-part series in the summer. The other series were in hiatus, so there was a gap there. And Neil came up with the original six-part screenplay for The Quatermass Experiment. He'd been thinking about German rocketry and all that kind of thing after World War II when the people like Wernher von Braun had gone to America and started helping the Americans with their rocketry. And he was thinking about that, and he kind of thought about, well, yeah, what kind of contagions could there possibly be in space, and what could happen if people went up there and caught something. And that's the basis of a very successful BBC series of six parts that was shown in 1953. So a couple of years later, Hammer got the rights to the screenplay for Quatermass Experiment from the BBC. Nigel Neal didn't get any money for it because he was working for the BBC at the time, and they didn't roll like that at that stage. And it was adapted for a movie that they were going to. So Hammer cut a deal with 20th Century Fox, and that is where Brian Donlevy comes into play, Professor Quatermass. Donlevy's career was on the skids a bit, and he was fairly cheap to get, so he was cast. The other main cast member who was American was the wife of Victor Caroon, the unfortunate astronaut in the movie, and I'll tell you a little bit about the synopsis in a moment. That role in the film was played by an actress called Marja Dean. Now, Marja Dean was the mistress of Spiros Skouras, who was the head of 20th Century Fox Pictures. Skouras wanted to help her career, but didn't want to do it in America in case there was a little bit of a gossip and a rumour go around. So he got her this deal where she kind of had a role in the Quatermass experiment, and she is atrociously bad. She just couldn't act, unfortunately. But leaving aside her and Don Levy, who isn't very good as Quatermass, it's a fantastic film. Now, the reason Don Levy isn't cool as Quatermass, he's big and blustery, he's very unsympathetic, and he's playing it like he's a cop in a 1940s Warner Brothers movie trying to bust a criminal gang. He's got that kind of bluster and things like that. And he was carrying around a flask of coffee with him on set, and it was only halfway through the filming of it that the director of the piece, Val Guest, found out that that coffee was liberally laced with brandy. Don Levy was an alcoholic, and they'd try to get the best they could early in the shoot, because later in the afternoon or towards the end of each shooting day, and there were some night shoots there as well, Don Levy was pretty much useless. So they had those problems. But having said that, a lot of the good stuff from Nigel Neill's script does shine through, and I'll try to find a little bit of a synopsis here to give it to you. A lot of people already know the film, but it doesn't hurt to just iterate at that. Okay, I found a good one on IMDb, so we'll go with that. Professor Bernard Quatermass is in charge of a manned rocket mission that has gone awry. The ground crew have lost contact with the spaceship at one point and have no idea how far in space it may have travelled. When the rocket crash lands in a farmer's field, they find that only one of the three occupants, Victor Caroon, is on board. The others have simply vanished. Slowly, the surviving astronaut begins to transform into a hideous creature, and Quatermass realizes that Caroon may have been infected by an alien disease. When Caroon escapes from the hospital with the help of his unsuspecting wife, the authorities race to destroy him before he can multiply. And that's pretty much it. By the way, there was a 2005 adaptation of this that the BBC did as a live broadcast. Had people like Jason Fleming playing Quatermass, and David Tennant was in it just at the time he started. It was announced that he would be Doctor Who. And it was done live to air. Yeah, they did all the rehearsals live to air, all the usual fuck-ups of live to air. But it's interesting just to see that one, because you never actually see the monster in it. And the monster, of course, being played in the movie version by Richard Wordsworth, an actor, very gaunt kind of actor, who does a fantastic job, without ever speaking, of playing Victor Caroon, the astronaut who comes back and who's slowly being mutated by whatever kind of alien life form he encountered up in space. And yeah, and people have compared Richard Wordsworth in this role with Karloff in Frankenstein. I can see it being a valid comparison. He doesn't get as much screen time as Karloff did in that movie, but it's still a fine piece of acting. Wordsworth mostly did stage work. He was very much a stage actor. He did a few other Hammer films and a few other movies as well, but his career was mostly on the boards. And it's a bit of a shame, because I think he did a terrific job here and should be given all credit for it as well. The other supporting cast, there are some interesting people in as well. A very early role for somebody that for whom I have a lot of time as an actor, and that's Lionel Jeffries' guys, who's involved with Quatermass and his rocketry group. And even though it's a very understated role compared to some of the over-the-top ones that Jeffries did later on, I do like him. He plays a character called Blake. And there's a little tiny bit in a police station with Thora Heard playing a kind of dotty woman who sees the monster in the city and goes to the cops about it. And she's one of those people who regularly goes to the police station and tells them outrageous things. And for the first time ever, she's right about it, which is kind of a nice little comedy bit. And the only other character of real significance in it is a cop called Inspector Lomax, played by Jack Warner. Not the Jack Warner from the Warner Brothers, but the English Jack Warner, who'd spent 22 years doing a TV series called Dixon of Dock Green, where he played a kind of street cop, a bobby, and he was very successful playing police roles his entire career. And from mid-1950s to the mid-1970s, he did this one TV series that just kept going on and on with him playing a copper. And he's kind of very, he's like the archetype, the iconic English copper in these, in this movie, and I kind of like him for that. And that's the thing about these British science fiction films that are set in Britain. And there is a differentiation there because there are British science fiction films that are set in outer space, of course. But there's that kind of home county's domesticity coming up against real alien menace. And this is a menace too. They've got a scene in Tessington Zoo where the Karoon monster has killed some animals. And they do a lot of stuff like they kind of, it reminded me a little bit of Cat People, where the cats, the big cats are pacing back and forward in their horrible 1950 zoo cages. Of course, you know, zoos are nothing like they were in those times. They try to give them as much of a natural environment as possible now. But they're in these little cages. They're kind of pacing backwards and forwards and getting agitated and all that kind of thing. And I kind of like the fact that that's a nice little trope in these kind of movies where even things like lions are agitated and scared of what's going past them. You never see the monster as it goes past them. All you see is the agitation of the animals. And I like that kind of obliqueness there where they don't show everything directly. I mean, the big axiom in movies is show, don't tell, and in a lot of other fiction as well. But in this case, they're kind of showing a reaction rather than showing the monster. And, of course, budgetary limitations meant that they couldn't show the monster. And with the special effects they had in the 1950s, with most kinds of monsters, if you see too much of them, then the verisimilitude kind of goes right out the window and you're stuck with, yep, that's a rubber monster. But in this case, they do pay off. They pay off quite nicely eventually, and you do get to see the monster. And I love this fact, and it's a really groovy thing, and it's a really silly thing. The monster that Les Bowie and his team made for this particular movie was mostly made out of cow entrails and tripe. Tripe being the stomach lining of cows. I've actually got some in the fridge I'm going to cook up at some stage in the future, and I know a lot of people don't like tripe, but too bad I do. So basically it was like rubber cement liquid rubber and basically animal entrails to make the monster. And even though it doesn't really hold up well in high definition, I saw it just in normal definition when I watched it most recently, and it kind of holds up nicely. It does have a certain look about it that is a little bit unlike anything you'd seen in cinema before. You've got to remember, this is before The Blob, and I think it's an effective monster. I mean, other people may disagree, but I think in this one, it really does pay off nicely. And everybody else in the movie, apart from Don Levy, who I detest in this movie, is slightly better in Quatermass 2, the second of the two films that he did. But I think they kind of pulled him back a little bit and made him a little less of the kind of gangbuster kind of character in the second one. And of course there's a lot more actors supporting him, and a lot better characters actors supporting him in the second one. But this is one of those iconic British science fiction movies, and it would have been nice if Hammer had kept doing more of these kind of films, but they decided around the time this was made and slightly after that they were going to steer into horror, which is great. I mean, I love the Hammer horror films, but I would have liked to have seen a more of a parallel trail of quality science fiction by Hammer. There were some, of course, Quatermass in the Pit in 68, Quatermass 2, Four-Sided Triangle, which came out before this one, and the one they did with Dean Jagger, X the Unknown, which the character is much more like the Quatermass of the teleplays than Brian Donnelly ever got near. And that one is worth doing. I may do that in a future podcast because I really like, I think I, in some ways and for some reason, I prefer it to the Don Levy Quatermass experiment because I think the characters work better and they're a little better with the special effects too. And in my mind, it's kind of a Quatermass movie that didn't have Quatermass in it, which sounds silly, but I think it really does show up as a better science fiction movie than this one. And I shouldn't have said that because this is the movie I'm talking about, not X the Unknown. Now, getting back to Mercer Dean, I'll just play a little bit of the dialogue from her bit in the movie just to show you what I mean about how unfortunate she is in this film.
Why don't you go and wait in the car, Judith?
It's funny. It looks exactly the same. Yet it's been, who knows how far. There isn't a word.
I'm not going to play any more than that because it is painful, her way with words in the movie. Now, she was probably a very nice person, but no, probably, you know, don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington, as far as she was concerned. But I'll play a little more of the dialogue just to show you what I mean about that brusqueness that Brian Dunleavy has as Quatermass, and kind of set up the home counties science fiction thing that I was mentioning as well. It starts out with a BBC announcer describing the return of the rocket ship. And while watching that scene, being a podcaster and being a microphone freak these days, the one thing I was watching all through the scene was the microphone and the attachments they had at the back of it. And compared to modern ones, they're very chunky, but it was a groovy-looking microphone. And if it could have been retrofitted, it would be a perfect podcasting mic, I reckon.
The object was first sighted at about 9:15 this evening, and its approach was widely observed over the southern counties. A statement just issued by the Home Office stresses that there is no general danger. Members of the public, however, are warned to stay away from the area.
The Home Office stresses that there's no immediate danger. Do you realize what you'll have to face if this turns out to be a disaster, Quatermass?
How much further?
I'm talking to you.
For the last 20 miles, I've been painfully aware of that.
Well, then answer, man. How did it happen? What went wrong?
For the first time in the history of the world, man has sent a rocket 1,500 miles into space. You can't expect such an experiment to be perfect.
Well, you must have had some idea.
I'm a scientist, not a fortune teller who predicts what will happen.
Well, you had instruments, radio contact.
We lost it for over 57 hours, sir. Broke loose, and we don't even know how far it's been. Had no further contact, even when it returned to the orbit.
Yet you brought it down by your own control.
Well, that's something to tell your ministry. Quatermass set it up and he brought it back.
Please, oh, please.
Couldn't you fix another time for this?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Croon.
I happen to be concerned with the Ministry of Defense.
Well, I'm not a civil servant. I'm a doctor, and I happen to be concerned with three men. The three men who are in that rocket.
Oakley Green. This is it.
Mr. Blake?
I'm Quatermass. I'll be in charge from here on, Inspector.
Can't say I'm sorry about that. What's the next move?
We can't do anything right now. Not until that cools off.
How long will that be, sir?
I would say 3 or 4 hours at least.
You won. This is Marsh. Do you hear me?
Oh, we've been there for 4 hours.
I suppose you'd like me to open it up right now, huh? One blast of air in against that heat would incinerate them.
Some reporters here from London, sir. They'd like some facts.
They'll get some later.
They'll get some now. Bring them on, Major.
Don't you think we ought to find out a few more ourselves first?
Bring them on, Major.
Are you hearing me, Q1? Are you hearing me? This is Marsh calling Q1. Q1, over.
You know, if I ever gave them all the facts, you'd find one or two of them difficult to explain.
Don't try and drag me through the mud, Blake. You might splash a little bit on yourself, you and your committee.
You deliberately launched that rocket without waiting for official sanction.
If the whole world waited for official sanction, it'd be standing still. You took too long. I made my own decision.
To gamble with three men's lives.
Every experiment is a gamble. The unknown is always a risk. They should know that.
Did she know that? That woman over there waiting, hoping and praying?
It's dropped another 100 degrees since we arrived.
Still got a long way to go.
Let's have that insulation lining doesn't crack out.
Yes, let's hope it didn't. Because if it did, Quatermass, and those three men in there are
dead or alive, they'll be heroes.
Are you all right?
Let me tell you something, Blake. They'll fire the imagination so that there'll be 100 men begging for the same privilege when we launch the second rocket. You can't stop it now.
Do you receive me?
You mean I can't stop you now?
See what I mean? The title character of the movie is deeply unsympathetic. He goes and launches a rocket into space for the first time ever without permission and decides that, dead or alive, the guys are heroes and they're going to inspire further rocketry. And even though that probably is pretty much in tune with a lot of the German rocketry during World War II, I'm not sure how well it plays, even in the 1950s. I mean, it's really a totally different character than the one portrayed in the television version of Quatermass, and of course, as Quatermass is in Quatermass in the Pit in 1968. With Andrew Keir playing the character. And later on, there was a mini-series as well. There was a few-part mini-series with John Mills playing Quatermass. So I haven't visited that one in a long time. But I'm anxious to kind of check that one out again. I have very kind of bad memories of it. But I'm willing to give it another go. But there are a lot of other aspects of this film I kind of like. Mentioning the microphone brings me up to the technology. The inside of the spacecraft is very 1950s diesel punky technology there. I kind of like watching old science fiction movies for all of those analog dials they've got. Late 1950s, 1960s, I don't like all the flashing lights. I think the flashing lights are a bit of overkill. But I do like old school dials and measuring devices and great big wheels you've got to spin to open hatches and all that kind of stuff. It's got a certain feel about it that's really kind of groovy and really works. It's a chunky spacecraft too. They do some really nice subtle matte work, and matte paintings work a lot easier in a black and white film like this than they did in a lot of the colour films that were contemporary to this movie. Yeah, but matte paintings are one of those things, a bit like Dutch angles and a bit like anachronisms where they say this happened in 1965 and all that kind of thing in old science fiction movies that you look on, even though they are a bit manky, with a kind of fondness. They were trying to do things within the technological limitations and show things that weren't actually there. And matte paintings and really dodgy sets and things like that, I've got a nostalgic fondness for at times, and a lot of that comes through in this movie. And it does end on a great dramatic note there, where the monster that Karoon becomes is about to spore and spread the spores everywhere, and those spores would end up taking over the Earth. So there was a real threat there, and it's shown in an interesting way because one of the spore pods is put into a glass tank with a mouse. Now, this wouldn't have ended well for the mouse, but at the time people weren't particularly members of PETA, for instance, people for the ethical treatment of animals. But it does show that they do use that little glass tank with the mouse in it and the spores to illustrate what might happen. So it's like a microcosm to explain a macrocosm. And that's very effective. And, you know, that kind of pulsing, blobby-looking thing in the tank is quite effective. And I think the tripe monster works well. I really do like the tripe monster. I was very impressed with that. And even though I'm going to have to find an HD copy of this movie for the simple reason that I want to see what it looks like in a close-up when you can see that it's made out of tripe and giblets. But I kind of admire the fact that they were trying to tell a fairly big story on a not-too-good budget. The movie was very, very successful in England. It was on a double feature with Rafifi, the movie, the Jules Dassin movie that I've talked about on Paleo Cinema before. And that's an odd pairing, but as I like both movies, I wouldn't mind a double feature with the Quatermass Experiment and Rafifi. I think that it's a weird pairing, but it kind of did work. And apparently there is some talk that when the movie was shown as The Creepy Unknown in America, a kid died of fright during the showing of the film at some American cinema. I don't have attribution for that. But IMDb reckons that it's the first time that somebody died of fright in a movie, which I kind of got to give them a slight and slightly reluctant kudos for. But anyway, that's about it for the Quatermass Experiment. Leaving aside Mercer Dean and Brian Donlevy, I think it's a good film. I think it would have been better with an English actor playing Quatermass. And I was trying to think who I would have cast as Quatermass in this movie. So you need an intelligent actor who can also have an edge to him. Somebody like Jack Hawkins, maybe, or Anthony Quayle. Somebody along those lines. Let me know if there's somebody you think would have made a better Quatermass in the Quatermass Experiment than Brian Donlevy. English actor, we'll stick to English ones, or Irish or Scots or Welsh. But who would you have cast in that movie who was acting at the time? And who would you cast now? Jason Fleming, I think, does a reasonable job of it. But I can see somebody like Anthony Hopkins going over the top and doing it these days. Who else would I do? Maybe Ian McKellen, though they're both so famous now that they might not be able to pull it off. And but anyway, that's the end of the Quatermass Experiment. I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a very different movie, which also has to some extent, a silent protagonist in it, and that is John Sayles' 1984 science fiction movie, The Brother from Another Planet. That was the star of the movie, Joe Morton, with a song from The Brother from Another Planet called Homeboy. This is a really interesting movie. First thing you need to know about it is this. 4 weeks pre-production, 4 weeks filming. That's it for the whole feature film. It was directed by John Sayles, one of the best indie directors around. And he had just done a few writing gigs for various studios. He'd done a draft of the movie The Clan of the Cave Bear and had some time spare and a little bit of money. So he decided that if he could make a movie for $350,000, he would do it. So he had three recurring dreams. The first one was a joke that a friend of his, Joe Dante, the movie director, told him about, which was that he wanted to do a movie called Assholes from Outer Space, which was a bunch of alien assholes who come down and go into the American government because it's a perfect fit for asshole aliens. That was one of his dreams. The second one was something called Bigfoot in the City, which was a film noir with a Bigfoot in it, kind of like Carol Reed's Odd Man Out. So that was another one of his recurring dreams. That one didn't pass out either. And the third one was an idea that became The Brother from Another Planet. Now, John Sayles lived in Hoboken at the time. One of his neighbours was David Strathairn, who plays the other man in black in the movie, which Sayles plays the first man in black. But there were a few things he wanted to do. He wanted to make the movie in New York in 4 weeks, with 4 weeks of pre-production before that. And he wanted to make sure, given the title of the thing, Brother from Another Planet, that he wasn't just a white guy coming in and telling black people how to be and how they are. So he did a number of things that were really interesting, a number of things which were very typical of John Sayles as a director. First one is he tried to get as much gender balance in the production team as he possibly could. Within what he could do, gender balance. Second thing was he wanted a number of people of colour involved, but he wanted good people. Now, the director, who's now a director, but he was the director of photography on the film, Ernest Dickerson, who you'll see directed a lot of episodes of Walking Dead, apart from anything else. He's done a lot of quality episodic TV recently. He was driving a cab at the time, and he got the opportunity to be the director of photography on this film. It was going to make him $80 a week, but with a back end if they made any money out of it. He went for the opportunity because he'd gone through the New York University Film School. He had the chops. He'd never worked in 35mm before, but he kind of lied his way into the job and became the director of photography. And a bunch of location people, a whole bunch of people in there, were local people from around Harlem, because they were going to be filming above 110th Street. Now, this gave them a big saving in money too, because at the time, nobody made movies above 110th Street in Harlem, because nobody did it. Now, the thing is that if you made a movie above 110th Street, the Teamsters Union wouldn't go there, which was put in their advantage, so they didn't have to pay union rates for guys driving trucks and all that kind of thing that the Teamsters Union had there. And so there were some advantages there. They saved a lot of money by doing that. They were had to film in the two summer months that they did. I think they did July and August, or August and September, one of those kind of things, because they wanted to get the good weather. And so they put together a team and they started making this movie. Now, I'll go into a bit of a plot synopsis of the movie, because in a kind of ways, you know, there's a trope, and that annoying trope of the magical black man. Well, it was called a magic Negro when it was originally put out there, where there's a magical black man that comes into town. He has magical abilities and he fixes all the problems of white people. Green Mile's an example of that. There are a few others. Bag of Vance being another one, that kind of thing, the magical Negro thing. This is the reverse of that in a lot of ways, but I'll do the synopsis and then I'll explain why. Actually, I'm going to give you two synopses. The first one's a brief one, and here comes the click when I click the mouse. And the other one's a slightly more detailed one. The one from IMDb says, a mute alien with the appearance of a black human is chased by outer space bounty hunters through the streets of Harlem. That's a bit simplistic and not entirely accurate. I'll get to the other one from IMDb now. The brother is an alien who has crash-landed on Earth in New York City. While mute, strongly empathic, and able to fix things, he resembles a black man with strange feet. He attempts to make a place for himself in Harlem, and the movie is an allegory for the immigrant experience in the United States. Meanwhile, two bounty-hunting men in black from the brother's home planet arrive and try to capture him. That's a little bit more accurate. So I'll just go through the cast. I was written and directed by John Sayles. It stars Joe Morton as the brother. Dee Bridgewater's in there doing an acting role, as well as singing in there, the singer. There are a few people. Bill Cobbs is in there. Steve James, who people know from any number of 1980s action films, is in there as a character called Odell, who runs a bar. Leonard Jackson as Smokey, and Daryl Edwards as Fly. There are a whole bunch of people there, including the long-term partner of John Sayles, who has a gang little bit as a kind of welfare public servant. Her name's Maggie Renzi. And there's also some bits in there by David Strathairn plays one of the men in black, and John Sayles plays the other. And they are seriously fucking freaky. They are the freakiest thing in the movie. And this is a movie with a black guy with three-toed feet in it. So why is this the reverse of the magic black man trope? Because the magic black man in this case doesn't help out white people particularly. He does things as a job. He fixes arcade machines because he can kind of touch them and telekinetically fix them. He fixes a bunch of other stuff as well, but he does it as a way of a job. It's not there to help out white people. It's not there for anything like that. He's an immigrant who has a certain skill set and who uses that skill set to, A, help his friends. There's a little boy who's got a cut on his leg. He heals the cut on the little boy's leg. And as a job. Now, the movie starts out with a really cheap and nasty spaceship crash landing into the ocean near New York, or into the harbor of New York. cost them $12 to do special effects for that. I don't know how they did it, but the rumours I've got in this really useful book I've got is a terrific look into John Sayles' career. It's got John Sayles, an authorised biography of the pioneering indie filmmaker by Jerry Molyneux. It's got a lot of stuff in there. $12 to do the spaceship crash. So the brother from another planet gets out of the spaceship. He's got one leg missing, which he regenerates overnight, and he jumps onto Ellis Island. Now, when they filmed this, they had 48 hours in Ellis Island. This is before it got renovated and turned into a museum of immigration and all that kind of thing. It was a derelict building, pretty much, and everywhere that they went to film, they were scaring away rats. The whole island was infested with rats. So the filmmakers made it there. The alien ends up on Ellis Island. And he's also got that kind of freaky psychic power of being able to touch things and see who touched them previously and who was there previously. And he gets this overwhelming impressions of the immigrants who came into Ellis Island throughout the years. And it just seriously freaks him out. So he jumps off the island and swims to Liberty Island and then takes the ferry back to Manhattan. Well, takes the ferry to Manhattan. He hasn't been there before, so he can't go back there. So he goes to Manhattan, ends up around Harlem, and wanders into the bar run by Odell and his friends. Now, I'll just play a little bit of the dialogue from that, because, as somebody has said, these guys turn bar talk into an art form. They're really, really cool. It's Bill Cobbs and the other guys that I mentioned just sitting in a bar, and the dialogue wasn't improvised. It was written by Sayles. But it's just given that beautiful spin, that beautiful delivery by the actors involved. And because it's so good, those actors need to be named again. There's Bill Cobbs, there's Steve James, Leonard Jackson, and Daryl Edwards.
Damn, Odell! Dumbass, this machine is fucked.
If it is, you fucked it.
Is that my spaceship right off the screen? We're not even close to it.
Maybe it was internal malfunctions.
What do you mean, internal malfunctions?
Spaceship doesn't have to get hit by nothing to crash. Some of them get internal malfunctions, like when the astronauts are cashing their tickets. That's what usually did it. Can I help you, brother?
That's the seat McVeigh was sitting on the night Percy Williams shot him. Don't nobody like to sit on that seat.
Something the matter, brother?
There's a power in that seat.
Machine is fucked.
Internal malfunctions.
Damn, did it again.
They say it won't be long before all those satellites they sent up there years back gonna be crashing back down to Earth. Insides wear out up there. Things go haywire.
Oh, man, they just get tired. You know, start out with this orbit that's real high and wide, and the next time around, get a little closer to Earth, the next time a little closer and so on, till gravity hook into it and come crashing down. You hear some noise on your roof, then you got a Sputnik sizzling in the living room.
I'll get you something to drink, brother.
Maybe you don't drink.
Man don't drink. What'd he come into a bar for?
Man is a fugitive from a chain gang. He got 100 to on him.
Man's a wino and should be out on the street.
Damn. Well, Dale getting hard-hearted since he owned this bar.
Yeah, Dale, ain't nobody after the charges on. Let the man sit.
Got bloodhounds at his heels.
He's got internal malfunctions, if you ask me.
Damn, old Dale, look at it now. Look what it's doing. Look like that thing they hook up to the dude's heart for surgery on TV.
You broke it, huh?
I ain't break nothing. Damn machine up and quit on me.
You sure you don't want nothing to drink, brother?
I want my quarterback.
You know what's on them satellites come crashing down? Diseases. Diseases we ain't even got a name for. Space germs.
Can't nothing live out in space, man. Not even germs. No atmosphere. Odell, get my quarterback.
These ones can.
Man sat on the death seat and he felt it. His seat's got a power to it.
Sit down, Smokey. You'll get dizzy again.
Huh?
Oh, this machine has had it. Get my quarterback, Odell.
Fly, I loaned you that quarter in the first place.
So as you can hear, there's light parts to this movie as well, but there are also very, very serious parts. There's a scene where the brother finds a dead junkie with a syringe in his arm and, not knowing any better, injects himself with the heroin and has a weird experience wandering through the streets of Harlem, basically affected by drugs, and this then teaches him that drugs are a bad thing. And there's a little subplot involved with that, and involved with the drug trade, which is a little out of pace with the rest of the movie, but it does show something very interesting, and it shows a weird kind of empowerment by this guy who, for the most of the movie, is either hiding from the men in black or just trying to figure out how to live on this strange planet and this strange place on this strange planet where people do odd things. There's a scene, really telling scene, where the brother walks past a shop which has, it sells crucifixes with Jesus on them as a thing. And he looks at the crucifix and he's shocked by it because it's obviously a scene of torture and of murder. And then turns across the street and there's a black man spread-eagled in a crucifix thing being frisked by a white cop. And he makes that connection there. There are any number of little scenes there that are a social commentary of a quite a serious and interesting way, which is seen through the weird lens of this guy being an alien from another planet viewing our world. There's also a nice comedy bit where he gets infatuated with a singer played by Didi Bridgewater, the singer. And because he doesn't speak, he dresses very nicely. He goes and sees her in a nightclub. She sits down next to him to have him pretend to be her boyfriend because the owner of the nightclub is hitting on her. And she wants to kind of dodge that bullet. And they end up spending the night together. So there's a really interesting little piece in that as well. But there are some scenes of very strange alienness. For instance, the men in black track the brother down to Odell's bar. And David Strathairn and John Sayles, with their hair slicked back and they're wearing black, walk into the bar. Now, they've got to try to make this look freaky. These guys are fucking aliens. They may not even be human in form, naturally. They are really fucking weird. So what Sayles does is he films them entering the bar backwards and reverses the film. So basically they walk into the bar backwards and do everything backwards as they come into and as they leave the bar. So the body movements look strange. Yes, they're ducking and weaving and moving a little bit like a lizard. But because it's actually filmed in reverse with them reversing all of the actions, it gives it that little eerie strangeness. It doesn't cost them any more to make. Remember, this is a $350,000 movie. It doesn't cost them any more to film things that way. It takes a little more time, but it doesn't cost them any more. But it does add to that weirdness. And there's a scene with the two men in black communicating with each other in their native language, which is seriously and deeply freaky. But I'll just play the audio now of when the men in black enter the bar and start asking questions about the brother and the reactions that the barflies have for them, which is kind of cool.
Beer.
What kind?
Draft. On the rocks. Have any of you seen this man?
We have reason to believe he's been in here.
Lots of people been in here. What's his name?
Didn't he tell you?
Kind of man gonna tell you his name when he can't talk.
Where is he?
Look, you all got any kind of ID?
ID?
Your badges, man.
Badges?
What badges?
We don't have to show you any badges.
Look, if you're dicks, you got badges.
What makes you think we're dicks?
I could answer that.
Well, look, if you ain't dicks, what the hell am I talking to you for then?
Government.
Who's government?
Immigration.
We have reason to believe this man is an illegal alien.
So's at the fucking city, so what?
Could we see your green card, mister?
Green card? Man, what you talking? Green card. Green card, my black ass. My people built this country, sucker. You ever been to South Carolina? Huh? My people built that.
Can't build a state, man.
Look, all I know is when they got off the boat, there wasn't nothing there. Not a shopping malls and, what's that shit? Miniature golf from nothing. Ask me for a green card. My people's in the revolution, Jim. How long you been here?
Keep the change, sport.
That's $2, ma'am.
We'll be back.
White folks get strange all the time.
But the guts of this movie, of course, is Joe Morton and his acting. And with no dialogue, he has to convey everything with his body and his face, and that he does an incredible job in this movie. It's one of the best bits of science fiction acting you're ever going to see. And there are times when his reactions are subtle, there are times when they're incredibly large. But somebody's compared Joe Morton playing the brother from another planet with Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp. He's got a little bit of that about him, but he's also got the fear and the innocence of an escaped slave, and which indeed he is. And as the Men in Black show, they're basically not unlike a lot of characters in Django Unchained in that regard. Ultimately, of course, there is a comeuppance which comes from unexpected directions, but even then, Sales shows a hell of a lot of imagination in the way that he portrays that and the way that he foreshadows it as well. This movie is a brilliantly imagined piece of fiction about the immigrant experience and about being a refugee. Now, that rang really true for me because there's a lot of discussion in Australian politics about refugee policy, and our government is doing monstrously cruel things in our name at the moment. And that's why movies like this that show through a different lens the experience of a refugee are so valuable, and why somebody like John Sayles is a very important filmmaker. Yeah, he did this in basically 2 months. He did it on a ridiculously small budget for a movie, even in 1984, that was shot in New York City. And yet he's made a piece of art that rings true in so many ways to so many people's experiences in so many different countries. And he does it with humour, he does it with compassion, he does it with a whole raft of interesting characters, some played by professional actors, some not. And he does it by making the location one of the characters as well. Harlem's definitely one of the characters in this movie. There's a bit where the brother and another guy are walking past a couple of prostitutes, and one of them shouts out to them, "Hey, I'll give you a blowjob if you fix my shoe," and things like that. There are those little street bits that kind of ring true to the kind of experience people have in places. And, this movie is really, well, it shows a few things. First off, it shows John Sayles and his cast as well and his crew. At the premiere of the movie, the producers were handing out envelopes to the people who'd worked on the film to give them the money. Most of them got like $80 a week, if that, to work on the film. But because they did a good distribution deal, at the time of the premiere, the producers did the right thing by their people and were giving them their back-end money in white envelopes at the premiere of the movie. They got together a whole bunch of people who had faith in the project, who wanted to get the experience and wanted to work with John Sayles, who was quite well-known as a quality independent filmmaker. But they did get their money back. The movie made back 10 times its budget. And that's just in the first release. This isn't like DVD money. This is the first release money for this film, made 10 times its money back. And everybody ended up getting paid, which is great. Now, Joe Morton, of course, has gone on to a long career. People remember him playing Henry in the TV series Eureka. He was also Miles Dyson in the Terminator movies, the guy who basically invented Skynet. And he's done any number of other quality pieces of work since then. Bill Cobbs you'll recognise because he's still a jobbing actor. He was born in 1934. He's still a jobbing actor. He's in the third Night at the Museum movie, for instance. And a number of people. Ernest Dickinson, who was going to be a cab driver because he couldn't make a money in cinema, is now a well-sought-after guy to make episodic TV for HBO and other things. He's made feature films as well. And a whole bunch of the other people that have worked on this film have gone on to have longer careers because of this silly little $350,000 movie that was made 30 years ago. And that's saying something. And, I mean, if I was going to do a science fiction film festival, if anybody wants to finance me to do one, I'd be very fucking happy to do it. This would be one of the movies I'd put in it because I think where I live here in Australia right now, it's a because of the refugee angle and the way that it approaches refugee stuff, it's an important movie and it's a movie that resonates with my culture at this time, even though it's about a black alien with three toes on each foot in New York City 30 years ago. It also goes to show something else which is really, really important. You can have a good movie without a big budget. You can have a good movie with ridiculously crude special effects. And there are times when there's some things in the movie look a little bit ropey. There's a climactic scene between the Men in Black and the barflies, which was meant to be a parody of kung fu movies, but they didn't have the budget and didn't have the time to do it that way, so it comes across as a little bit silly. But it kind of works in its own kind of quirky, skewed universe. But it shows that if you've got the right script and you get people together and you've got a lot of goodwill, a quality science fiction movie can be made on a not very large budget. There are a couple of Australian films that are showing that at the moment that are coming out in cinemas, which show some promise in that direction. But there's not too much else I want to say about The Brother from Another Planet. If you saw it in the 80s on VHS, as I did, and it was quite a popular VHS tape here in Australia at the time, every video shop had it. Revisit it. See if you can get a DVD copy. I'm going to have to actually fork out for this DVD. I like it that much. And revisit it because I think it's worthwhile. I think it shows what could be done with guerrilla filmmaking if you know, if you've got a good script, you've got a good premise, you've got incredibly talented people working for you, and you don't have a lot of time. But anyway, that's about it for that. There isn't really any feedback. There is a bit of paleo cinema feedback, which I'll get to next time, but there's not much Martian drive-in feedback. Just remember, the question for the podcast, and I want some responses, is who would you get to play Bernard Quatermass if you were remaking or doing a new Quatermass movie in 2014? So I'm going to let you go now with the credits. I forgot the credits in the last Paleo Cinema. I do apologise to all the Patreon campaign contributors. And again, the campaign is ongoing. So if you want to support the podcast by forking out $1 or $2 a month, you can do so by going to Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema and signing up there. It'd be lovely if you did. And you get to choose a movie for one of the podcasts if you do. Anyway, I'll leave you with the credits now. And the other credit we've got there, of course, is Matomatic. I've forgotten about Matomatic, but he's definitely in the credits. And Matomatic is our Rattlesnake Wrangler. So I'll see you guys again next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast and in 2 weeks with a Martian Drive-In podcast. In the meantime, watch the skies, look after yourselves, and kiss the people you love. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the Technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved. And if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema.